bulla, te suplico que también me saludes a la tuya.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 20th of February. Very nice to have you with us, hearing the music of legendary Mexican singer Paquita La Del Barrio, who died this week at the age of 77, and we'll be hearing music from Paquita coming up throughout the morning. And we remind you that you can always find a playlist of the cool stuff we play on our website, wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. So good morning, all. Welcome. Very nice to have you here. We have a great group. We have a lot of stuff to talk about. And so we needed the A-team, so we called them in, and here they are. We're thrilled. Don't worry. If you're a panelist and you're not in this group, I'll tell you you're the A-team when you're here. because it's basically true. We have a lot of members of the A-team, which is just a wonderful, wonderful thing to have. Let me introduce everyone to you, and then we will get started. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is with us. Good morning, Teresa. Hello. How are you?
Hello, hello. Doing well on National Leadership Day and one that you'll love, National Love Your Pet Day.
Oh, National Love Your Pet Day.
And you love your pet.
I love my dog very, very much.
So you're ready to celebrate.
Yeah, we're ready. I think we've already started celebrating, actually. jumped up in bed and We had loveys this morning, so yeah.
Isn't every day National Love Your Pet Day in your house, really?
That's very, very, very true. Yeah. We also welcome former New York 19 congressman and former New York assemblyman, dear friend of the station, has been with us for so many years. John Faso is here. Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Great to be with you on this frosty morning. And now that we have National Pet Appreciation Day, we can maybe convert this to a discussion about all creatures great and small.
Oh, that would be good. Isn't that a great show?
It's really terrific. It's like the getting a Hallmark card show every single day when you watch
it. It's just beautiful. It makes you happy. It is just, it's everything you want in a television program. It's on Masterpiece.
Yeah, we haven't watched it. I think maybe it's time.
Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, Libby.
I know.
This is your business.
I know, but I was watching Call the Midwife. And that's I really love that. So, but maybe we'll start.
This is different.
Okay. Fine.
Mark Whitman is with us, investment banker on Wall Street. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. I'm on my way. This is only a stop for me today. Our family is headed to Lake Placid.
Ooh.
Yeah, my son actually is playing in a hockey tournament there, which is particularly exciting for me as a Minnesotan. Why? Because this is the 45th anniversary of the Miracle on Ice.
Yes.
And my son's actually going to play.
Oh, you mean
on at least
ice?
One of those rings?
On that ring.
Yeah.
Right.
That's cool. Is so neat. I'm so excited.
That's very, very cool. That's really good. Excellent. I saved Libby to last because yesterday was Libby's birthday.
Yes.
And we wish Libby a very, very happy birthday. And
thank you.
We're thrilled you're here today. Did you have a lovely celebration?
Yes. Yeah, it was a busy day because people were like, why are you working? It's your birthday. Because I have to work. But and I had things to do. But we had a lovely dinner last night with friends.
Excellent.
It was just an overall very nice day. You know, that's what Facebook is for. Is for your birthday.
is to get attention on your birthday.
Almost 500 people.
Well, that's
me
great.
Happy birthday on Facebook.
And you're very forward. You tell people how old you are. You don't care
because I raise money.
Yeah, you raise money, and then that's not for yourself.
No, I raised money this time was for the New York State Animal Protection Pack.
Yeah, so. Which is really great.
Yeah.
By the way, when I saw that number, I was like, she is not.
I know. I don't look it. I know.
You do not look it. But congratulations.
Thank you. And just to be clear, I don't do anything to my hair. I just want to be very clear about that. They grow very late in my family.
Yeah.
Very late.
Well, that's good. Yeah. I mean, and who cares?
Yeah. I mean, I don't care. I know.
I know.
So, but.
Happy birthday.
Thank you, darling. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Let's get started and figure out what is going on in this world of ours. We have many, many things brewing, and we will talk about as many as we can in the time we have allotted for us. So we begin with, as the New York Times puts it, Trump flipping the script on the Ukraine war, blaming Zelensky, not Putin. I will read you from that article, and then we will break up into individual groups and discuss.
I'll just keep talking to myself.
When Russian forces crashed over the borders into Ukraine in 2022, determined to wipe it off the map as an independent state, the United States rushed to aid the beleaguered nation and cast its president, Volodymyr Zelensky, as a hero of resistance. 3 years almost to the day later, President Trump is rewriting the history of Russia's invasion of its smaller neighbor, Ukraine. In this version, is not a victim, but a villain. And Mr. Zelensky is not a latter-day Winston Churchill, but a dictator without elections, who somehow started the war himself and conned America into helping. Mr. Trump's revisionism sets the stage for a geopolitical about-face unlike any in generations as the president embarks on negotiations with Russia that Ukraine fears could come at its own expense. By vilifying Mr. Zelensky and shifting blame for the war from Moscow to Kyiv, Mr. Trump seems to be laying a predicate for withdrawing support for an ally under attack. The sharp exchange of words between Mr. Trump and Zelensky this week signaled how much has changed with the inauguration of a new president in Washington. Even for Mr. Trump, who has never been a fan of Ukraine and has long expressed admiration of Vladimir Putin, the vitriol expressed toward Mr. Zelensky drew gasps of surprise on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Mark?
Well, Joe, we should have seen this coming. If you remember back in Trump 1 when Putin and Trump met in Helsinki, and the topic of the day was, had the Russians tried to and interfered with U.S. elections? And almost everyone in the security apparatus in the United States was telling President Donald Trump that that had happened. Vladimir Putin said it had not happened. And if you remember, Vladimir Putin pulled off this amazing feat. I didn't know he knew how to speak English without an accent, but somehow, from across the room, he basically had Trump repeat the Russian talking points with respect to the issue of had Russia interfered in the U.S. election. His ventriloquist skills were amazing. Not even as good, by the way, as Tom Homan's are with the New York City mayor, but even better. So what is Trump laying the groundwork for? Well, Trump wants out of the war, and he wants to significantly reduce the U.S. military presence for and support of Europe. What's he doing? He's making Vladimir Zelensky the bad guy. He's a dictator. He started the war, which is an amazing proposition, by the way, to invade yourself. I'm not sure how that works, mm-hmm. but that's the assertion. Why does he do that? Because he's going to sell Ukraine out. It's going to be a disaster. It will be either a husk of a state or potentially even a state with warring factions or battling factions, battling itself under Russia's shadow, not a successful country any longer. And it will be Trump's responsibility. But if you start by blaming the whole affair on the Ukrainians themselves and the person of Vladimir Zelensky, you can somehow then take the political position that you didn't make a mistake in the negotiations and in selling out Ukraine. And by the way, when I say mistake, I mean the administration, if you look at their approach to negotiations, the number of rookie mistakes that they have already made is jaw-dropping. There's no way you should have the Secretary of State of the United States sitting across the table from his alleged counterpart while there are still hostilities going on. You should have held out for at least sort of a everybody stays in their bunker and low burn kind of a ceasefire. So, I mean, the number of errors that they've already made. And then just one more thing. you know, Trump is going to jump up and down when Putin says, well, in order for us to get peace, you've got to lighten up your U.S. military presence in Europe. And Trump's going to come out of the room, or his representatives will, and say, you know, it was a hard concession, but we're going to give it to him because we want the dying to stop. This is nonsense. It's consistent with what Trump has done. Even his own advisors historically wondered aloud what the Russians have on him. I don't know whether they do or don't. It doesn't matter. He always acts as if they do. And that's how we should presume this is going to continue.
One thing I just have to point ask you about and maybe point out is that when you say make mistakes, and I understand what you're saying, of course, because by history and by the rules that we've been operating under for hundreds of years, that's what you do. But obviously, in every step, in almost every corner of this administration, things are different. And I think the whole point is either mistake or just to do things differently, right?
Well, when you say differently, Trump wants to come to a solution quickly. By the way, he's already failed utterly on his promise to the world, which was to get this war done before he was inaugurated. So no matter what he does, he's a failure on this topic. But he wants it done. He wants it done quickly. That's why he's trying to sideline the Ukrainians and the Europeans from the initial rounds of discussions. But in doing that, they've already given away more than they should have and not accomplished nearly as much as they should have in order to have the level of talks that they're already having with the Russians.
John.
Well, I completely disagree with what President Trump's comments yesterday. To compare Zelensky and say he's a dictator and compare him unfavorably to Putin, I think is just totally wrong. And it's frankly, I'm reminded of Neville Chamberlain going to Munich and thinking we were going to have peace in our time. I think that the president has approached this in every way in a bad fashion. I really think that he runs a great risk here of having the destruction of Ukraine and its fledgling democracy on his watch. And I think that will send a terrible signal to our adversaries around the world and our allies in Europe, et cetera. Now, the president is correct that the Europeans haven't done enough, that they are disorganized in terms of their response. They do not have a coherent, unified position necessarily. Obviously, the Baltic states and Poland have been the strongest against what Putin has done, as has the UK. The French and the Germans, frankly, the Germans, I'm reminded of what Churchill once said about the Germans. He said, they're either at your feet or at your throat. And they have vacillated tremendously. They had, you know.
We've said that about Libby.
I'm never at his feet.
Not after her birthday.
No.
But, you know, the fact is that I think, you know, maybe this is some grand stratagem that the president has in mind, but I don't see it. And I think that this entire thing is shaping up as a fiasco. Comparing Zelensky and elections in Ukraine to non-elections and fake elections in Russia is absurd. So, I mean, on every count, the president's statements from when shortly after Putin invaded Ukraine, he said Putin was a genius. On every count, I think his statements and policy have been wrong. I would note that he gave weapons and Stinger missiles, etc., to Ukraine in 2017, 2018. I don't think he's in the pocket of Putin. I think he views this as simply another transactional situation. And people's lives and freedom and the question of democracy versus a totalitarian state, I don't think those can necessarily be transacted away.
Let me just ask a follow-up question, which, because I think I just want to fully understand as I try to fully understand this, your very good point about while those in Europe have perhaps been somewhat disorganized in this matter, but was not the chance on Monday when they were all sitting down in Saudi Arabia discussing this, that would have been an opportunity to bring in European counterparts to have a discussion as opposed to keeping everybody else out?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to second guess that, because I think what they want, what the Trump administration, what the president wants to do is to get a better understanding with Russia, with Putin on this. And again, everything the president does in this regard is transactional. I just fervently believe that certain things are above and beyond the mere transactional. You're dealing with a country that was invaded by Russia without provocation. You're dealing with a country that's a fledgling democracy, not by any means perfect, and we're not perfect after 250 years either.
No.
But Zelensky was elected. Their constitution says they have martial law in the case of war. That's why there's not a subsequent election in Ukraine. Zelensky is not as popular as he was, say, 2 years ago. That's almost to be expected, but it's certainly not at 4%. Polling that I've seen says he's still above 50%, about where President Trump is in the U.S. So I just hope that there are cooler heads in the administration that can kind of get the president off of this cliff that he's put himself on, which I think is a very dangerous one. Regardless of him, it's very dangerous for our country and democracies generally for us to be in this position. So I fervently hope that there may be some things going on that we're not aware of. But frankly, his comments are simply unacceptable and outrageous from my point of view. And I think actually most Republicans believe that as well.
Go ahead.
To educate me, because I really am not trying to figure this out. In terms of you meet with Putin first or the Russians first or not, I would have thought that you would meet with your allies and Zelensky and those folks first to get all on the same page. But why do you think it's a better strategy, or it's an okay strategy, that they did the opposite? That's something I've been confused about. I'm just confused.
Well, remember,
I don't disagree.
President Trump met with Zelensky in Paris in December, and there have been emissaries that have met with Zelensky. Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, was meeting with him last week. So,
but you had the allies all together, and it was post this.
Yeah,
you know,
if I may, that Bessent meeting though was an attempted shakedown.
Right.
I mean, that wasn't a how do you see the world? That's we want your minerals for what we've already given you.
Yeah,
separate, abhorrent thing. Yeah,
I wouldn't necessarily say it's a shakedown, but I would say again, it's his approach. Everything is a transaction. Okay.
So transactional shakedown.
it's all a shakedown.
But if the concern is that there's not a coherent, and I thought that the allies had come together, but if they weren't, why wouldn't they meet with them first?
I think, frankly, the Europeans are pretty disorganized in terms of their approach on this. There's a lot of fissures. The Germans, for instance, have a very different policy from the UK, which has a different policy from the French.
Yeah.
And certainly the Poles and the Baltic states and Finland and Sweden are much tougher, as
Absolutely.
They should be. They're closer to the bear, and the bear is hungry, and the bear wants to gobble up more. Look, Putin.
I don't think he stops at Ukraine, do you?
No, I don't.
I don't think so at all.
Remember, you know, this guy went into Georgia, back in 2011 or 12. He is a voracious. He believes the biggest single catastrophe of the 20th century was the fall of the Soviet Union. He's a former KGB guy, and he believes that he wants to reconstitute the Russian Empire as they traditionally have seen it. So that's what's going on here. And I think, we need to stand four square against that.
Libby? Oh, okay.
Libby?
Go ahead. Wait a minute.
Oh, well, do we need a break?
No, we're good.
Okay. Well, you know.
I bought some time.
Libby just wants to agree with me, so she's priming herself to do
well,
that.
Well, actually, John, I was going to say, surprisingly enough, I agree with most of the things you said. But I do think that that this isn't just transactional. This is Trump wanting to be Putin-esque, wanting to be the dictator of the United States. That somebody, they said, someone said recently, I mean, I read it, long live the king. I mean, give me a break. He is not the king. He's never going to be my king, that's for sure, nor will he be the king of the country. I think that Putin may have something on him, but regardless of the fact that the military machinations within Europe are different, there is NATO. And Trump has made it very clear he is abandoning NATO. He doesn't care about that. He wants Putin to do whatever he's going to give Putin the permission to do whatever he wants to do. He's not going to stop. He wants to recreate the motherland. Putin does. There's no two ways about that. And he won't stop at the Ukraine. And I think Trump is willing to write the check and give Putin Ukraine for whatever it is that he gets in return. This man, Trump, is not someone who should be have his finger on the lever of the nuclear launch codes or anything else in terms of government. What he is doing to our government and what he is doing to our foreign policy has totally, in just what? What's it been? 3 weeks?
Days.
Three yeah. weeks?
Third, would you 32 say 32 days?
32 days? 32 days has Monday totally has Monday. Totally undermined the United States' credibility on the world stage. It is undermining our economy. People need to understand. You lay off all those people in Washington, D.C., there's going to be an economic downturn in that city. People are going to have to move. Who's going to buy those houses? Right? There's going to be economic
problems.
Federal
workers are all over the country.
Right, I get that. But still, in Washington, D.C., and in other parts of the country, people, thousands upon thousands of people losing their jobs is going to mean an increase in unemployment insurance that he's not going to want to have to pay. And economic downturn across the country because of this, as well as everything else that he's doing.
I understand that this is all interlocked, but I just want to stay for a moment. Let's just stay with Russia. And
Russia will take over whatever it wants to take over because Trump is not going to put a brake on it.
Teresa was asking questions, but I didn't hear her response yet. But Mark, did you want to?
Sorry, don't let Teresa go.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I appreciate what you said, John. I wonder, and I think, you know, maybe this is for the later conversation, but why your former colleagues, Republican colleagues in the House and the Senate, can't say that same thing. That's deeply, right. deeply troubling.
That was my next question.
I think people started to say this. It's not enough
not
yet,
in
my
clear
opinion.
And concise way that you did.
Well, I mean,
and
we're
I
here.
I really appreciate
you, know,
you, you did.
Yeah, but I think this whole notion of Trump as a Putin toady is really way overstated. Trump gave offensive weapons to Ukraine in 2017 and 18. Trump also argued for the cancellation of the Nord Stream pipeline, which was the main economic lever that the Russians had to control and influence Germany. And that was a very controversial thing. The Germans didn't want him to do it. So he did that. So I think too much of the rhetoric is like, oh, he's a toady. They have something on him. I don't believe that. But I really believe that he sees the great powers. He sees himself as a leader of a great power. He sees Putin as a leader of a great power. And he believes everything's a transaction. I can get in the room. We can make a deal. It's one of his most favorite expressions.
But he's not a good deal maker. I mean, everybody keeps saying that he's a great negotiator. What is the proof of that? I don't mean to say it in that tone, but what is the proof of that?
I'll give you one example, Teresa. He is a bull who walks around with his own china shop, and he said early on that the European countries are not contributing what they should be to NATO. And it's right. They're not spending their own money on their own defense in the level that they need to have a fully functioning NATO. And so the European nations kicking and screaming, have gradually increased their commitment to NATO.
And Biden got him to do more. But what about in his own business as a negotiator? I mean, he's bankrupt six times. He has a reputation for not paying his own employees. He has a reputation for not honoring his contracts. He has a reputation for bringing everything to courts to slow things down. But separately, back to this more broadly. We talked about this yesterday. I do believe that this is a almost cataclysmic realigning of our alliances and in ways that we do not know where this is going. I don't think if those folks, they're playing checkers when China and Russia are playing chess. Mm-hmm. And I find that deeply, deeply, deeply concerning because you're right. He's not going to stop at Ukraine. They're going to keep rolling through, right? And you have to wonder, there were these reports back in October of this series of conversations that Elon Musk was having with Putin. What was that all about? Is there any relationship? I was noting, in this dismantling of the federal government, what are the one things that they did early on? They dismantled the federal agencies that monitor foreign interference with our elections. They are weakening CISA. All of these areas where we had fire breaks to protect us from foreign interference in our data systems, in our elections, a whole series of things, our cybersecurity, they are dismantling, they're weakening those. At the same time, there are these interactions with Russia that just seem incoherent with our short, long-term historic interests. There is a concern about what's going on here. Well, I think we have to be worried about that. And the silence of the Republicans is deafening on this. And it is deafening and dangerous.
And John, you pointed out that Trump helped Zelensky in 2019. Okay. So did he have a mind fart and forget that and then call Zelensky the dictator and the one who started the war? I mean, the man is incoherent in his proclamations. We all know who started that war. We all know that it was Russia who invaded Ukraine.
But he does that to everybody that's a disinformation
but
strategy.
But that's his thing. He is gaslighting not just the country on domestic policy, but the entire world.
And who did speak up firmly yesterday? Mike Pence.
Right, I know.
I mean,
that was
amazing to me that I am applauding Mike Pence.
I know.
But more of that, please. He says, Mr. President, Ukraine did not start this war. Russia launched an unprovoked and brutal invasion, claiming hundreds of thousands of lives. The road to peace must be built on the truth. We need more of that from Republicans.
So why does he, what is the benefit, this is for anyone who wants to answer this, but what is the benefit in saying what he said and rewriting that history in his statement yesterday?
Well, candidly, I don't see any benefit, although he may have some motivation that this is what he needs to bring Putin to terms.
Because
I don't really believe that because everything that we've seen since 2019, especially his grotesque remark that Putin was a genius mm-hmm. about a week after the unprovoked invasion. So,
supporting him, not our own.
Yeah, I think the risk here for the United States, not to mention the risk for his administration, the risk to the United States is that Ukraine is capitulated and put under the influence of Putin and Russia. And what is the message that sends to Xi Jinping as it relates to Taiwan? So,
Who else can ever
am I
trust
stealing
us?
Your line, Mark?
No,
well, let me just by the way, China was lost when this country couldn't even be bothered to get everyone in Congress to agree to put arms in crates and send them over to Ukraine. If we can't do that simple thing on behalf of 40 million people who were attacked unprovoked, who are being killed, raped, their children are being stolen, Xi Jinping has concluded, and rightfully so, I believe, that there's no way once he can get by our subs in the Taiwan Strait that we're gonna commit ourselves to putting American lives on the line for 20 million people who are still at the other end of what's arguably an unfinished civil war. China's done. I mean, it's just a matter of time on that one. The Europeans, John, I totally agree. They're a mess. You know how they're a mess? Because they knew this was coming, and they haven't still appointed one emissary to interface with the United States in the talks. They would have gotten their stuff together months ago if they weren't such a mess. All they did in the Elysee Palace.
I don't know why we're blaming the Europeans.
I'm not blaming them, but they do add a level of complication to this. And they also are the excuse that Trump's going to use when the Russians say, we want you to lighten up your military presence in Europe. And Trump's going to say, well, I did it to save lives. Why does Trump make Zelensky the bad guy? And why does he make Ukraine the aggressor? He does that because he knows that his short-term goal is to get to a deal. The deal's going to end in disaster. But if you blame the problem on the Ukrainians and it doesn't work out, you can hide behind the fact that they started it. They had a dictator anyway. I'm sorry things aren't working out for them, but it was a mess to begin with when I got here.
Isn't it simply a U.S. disinformation campaign? He wants to convince his base that what he's doing is legitimate.
Yes.
It's an internal disinformation campaign, mm-hmm. like a lot of his election was. He's lying to his people so that they stick with him. He
Correct.
Is lying to his people, and that's why...
Well, he's lying to all of us.
He's lying to all of us, but he wants to hold his base and the people who voted for them. So he is lying to them so that they begin to accept the fact that he is going to hand over Ukraine, which he has no right to do, to the Russians. He's giving up Ukraine to the Russians, and he's weakening our allies, and he's trying to convince the people in the United States that it's legitimate to do by demonizing Zelensky. It's an internal disinformation campaign.
Can I just one thing? Can I talk about the
yes, we
the
do
issue,
have to go to a break, but go
the,
ahead.
The issue with the way Trump is thinking about this is he's thinking once he gets to a deal, he's become successful. Mm-hmm. Vladimir Putin has no such delusions. He is playing the long game. And John, I totally agree with the fact that he's got thoughts about returning to a grander Russia, but I believe that's motivated by an Orwellian view that Putin now has that if he's not always at war, he can't keep quote unquote peace or at least control internally. And if he doesn't keep control internally, his throat gets slit. This was a man that within minutes of Prigozhin heading a simple column down the street to Moscow vacated the palace and hid. This man is afraid for his life. The only way he continues in power for the rest of his natural life is that Russia is now always at war.
But didn't
the United States, the Europeans, and particularly Trump need to keep this in mind when we think about a quote unquote solution to the Ukrainian war.
But by doing this, didn't and this is a question, not a statement, but I am fired up. Didn't Trump embolden Putin in his own country by doing this? Because he's been a pariah
yes.
across the
yes.
world. And this gets his people cheering from him, who were saying, why are you letting all of our people get killed?
But the reports yesterday from intelligent observers of Russian media was that the Russian media was gobsmacked
right.
that they were actually quoting the American president, echoing what the Russian president had said.
What we're hearing, and there's a scroll on CNN as we speak, Trump aligns with Russian talking points.
Right.
And, yeah, Libby.
And one more thing. Zelensky's positive polling is at 57%.
And he said it was 4%. Trump
right.
said it was 4%.
Right.
He's just lying.
57%.
Well, no, there's a whole footnote on that Zelensky popularity. If there were an election today, you can't hold one. It's not reasonable to even expect that. But if you did, no. Zelensky would lose to Zeluzhny, his general that he fired, most likely. Most intelligent observers say that. So I'm sure Trump's gotten some intelligence about that, and he said, okay, I can distort this and use this. Now, and Zelensky, has he made mistakes? Of course, but so do saints, frankly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's seriously
well, last week in Washington, I actually spoke to a Ukrainian member of parliament, and I asked her about Zelensky's popularity. And she said, yes, it has declined a great deal. But be that as it may, He still was democratically elected. They are at war. I understand why they can't have an election. I mean, frankly, the Russians would target polling places with missiles, etc. I mean, so the notion that Ukraine inspired this war is just ludicrous. It's very, very damaging, not just to the United States, but to the people who love freedom around the world.
And why can't Republicans say that?
Okay.
Let's do that after.
We'll take a break, we'll be back and continue. We've got a barn burner going here today. This is great. Teresa Bourgeois, John Fasto, Libby Post, and Mark Whitman, we welcome your letters. We have a ton of them. We'll get to as many as we possibly can. We'll return right after the short break.
Desgraciadamente, hoy fue diferente.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Yeah, you got the group all riled up. This is great. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC. You're riled up too. We have a lot of letters, and I'll get to those in just a moment. Is there anything before we get to letters? Is there anything that anyone would like a point that we would make to help round this out before we go to the letters?
I have a question that I'm deeply concerned about. Why did Trump go to negotiate this with the Saudis? Why Saudi Arabia of all places?
Well, there is a potential explanation there, and that is the world price of oil. Putin has been able to finance his war against Ukraine and his purchase of missile technology from Iran and his purchase of troops from North Korea. He's been able to finance that by the way he's able to evade the sanctions regime on the export of Russian oil. He makes big profits when oil's at $70-something dollars a barrel. Trump's goal is to get oil at $50 a barrel. And that would be an enormous economic shock to Russia. I have no doubt, and I don't know this because anyone's told me, but semi-educated guess here or analysis is that one of the reasons they're in Saudi is because the Saudis are integral to Trump's goal of getting oil at 50. And I think that's part of the machination of this negotiation. He wants oil prices down. That hurts Russia's ability to conduct war.
I just think it's family business.
I think that's a brilliant insight. I also wonder if it doesn't line him up on Iran as well.
This is all related, in my view, to his negotiation in terms of how he pressures Russia. The fact that he's not saying it, I don't think matters here because he's doing a lot of this bluster, I believe.
And you don't think it's his business interests, his family business interests, and his.
No. I really think if you look at the fundamentals of where does Russia get the money to finance their economy and their war, it's $70 plus barrel price of oil.
But the Saudis aren't.
Saudis would be very happy to get oil prices down as well for their own reasons. So I think that's one of the reasons they're in Saudi.
It's also true that the Russian economic rope is starting to fray. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, putting this in Saudi Arabia and having them involved. You know, the one thing you have to ask yourself is when big parties get involved in negotiations, there is a reason anyone on the other side of the table who's not a direct combatant is involved. It's because they've got something they can give or threaten as part of the negotiations.
And the old expression, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu.
and our allies were not at the table, right. Nor was Ukraine.
Right, and there you go. They
exactly
figured it out.
Right.
They're on
because
the menu.
They don't care because Trump doesn't care about them. He just doesn't care about them. He cares about power.
Trump cares about the short run.
But what's the economic
run,
impact to the U.S. in terms of the overall goal of making life better for the Americans? If we want to just be internal
about
it, right?
Price of eggs are still really high, aren't they?
And they just laid off the Agriculture Department folks who are working on the bird flu, by the mm-hmm. way. Oops.
Yeah.
Oops.
Oh, we're so sorry. Oops. And the FDA and everybody else. People are going
to
die.
Anyway, back to the sorry.
That's what's going to happen here,
back
folks.
Back to the letters.
People are
but
going to die.
But what about the breadbasket of Ukraine that we had relied on?
Right. Right. Grain. USAID shut it down. Farmers are going to be adversely impacted. Grain is rotting. People are going to die. RFK wants to redo the childhood vaccine schedule. Kids are going to die.
All right, let's go
That's the legacy here.
Teresa said, let's go back to letters. We're going to start to letters. Yes.
Go back to your effort to do that.
Yeah, there you go. Here we go. Paul says, considering Trump's vindictiveness, his sudden turn on Zelensky and Ukraine has everything to do with the fact that Ukraine had the nerve to reject the U.S. demand for their resources in exchange for further support. That from Paul. We go to Dolores. I'm a Democrat. Teresa, the silence of the Democrats is also deafening.
I don't see Democrats being quiet.
No, they have been vociferous about
this. I see the media not necessarily paying as much attention to
them. I will agree with...
You mean about Ukraine?
I will agree with Dolores, not so much on Ukraine, but on other issues of Doge and the like. I think they are being
People keep saying that, but I guess they are holding town meetings. They are going to the Department of Education. They're going... Anyway, it's not breaking through, but they are there. They are talking. And anyway, but they were vociferously out there on this issue on Ukraine.
On Ukraine yesterday. John says, I don't see any difference between NATO expansion in Eastern Europe and the Cuban Missile Crisis. You tell me what the difference is.
The argument the writer is making is that NATO expansion threatened Russia's vital security interests. That's the Russian argument. And he makes the comparison of Russian missiles in Cuba in 1962 and that threatened the U.S. vital security interests. We all know how that ended. Kennedy got the Russians to withdraw their missiles, and we withdrew some missiles from Turkey. That was a deal at the time. President Kennedy handled the issue correctly, in my view. But I don't think there's any evidence that Putin and Russia are directly threatened by a democratic Ukraine, other than the fact that their people will see next to them, and so would Belarus, a healthy, thriving democracy where the people make the choices about their government. Right. And that's not something that Putin, who views Ukraine as really as intrinsically and historically part of Russia. The Russian czars, Peter the Great and Catherine the Great, they all viewed Ukraine the same way that Putin does.
That he really believes it's his.
Yeah. Well, but also the you highlight the internal disruption that was going to be caused as Ukraine became ever more successful and ever more Western-looking. That goes back to the Orwellian issue, that as economic conditions in Russia tightened, Putin had no choice but to start external wars, and now he's got no choice but to continue them for his natural life.
Because they're democracy adjacent, basically, and you can't block that reality out.
Well, if he doesn't have that excuse to control his own population, they'll slit his throat.
And that's also why Putin does not want Ukraine to become economically integrated with the EU. It's the same thing. Right. It shows the Russian people that, hey, right next door. And remember, a lot of Russians and Ukrainians are related, have familial relationships. Mm-hmm. So it shows people right next door, hey, there's a better system than the one we have.
That's what I'm saying.
Right. And I have to say, there's a history of borders just shifting in those areas for years and years. I mean, I'm from Ukraine. My grandparents were from Ukraine.
I thought you had an accent.
Yes, thank you. And that, you know, then they weren't because the borders,
changed. It's like they evaporated Poland in the 1790s because they partitioned it.
So things just, keep moving. But the fact of the matter is that, bottom line, Putin wants to recreate the motherland. We can't ignore that. Georgia, Ukraine, he'll go after all the little Balkans. Everything that used to be part of the USSR. He'll just keep going. And then he'll go after Finland and the European nations that border on them. Because he wants to be the king of the world. It's just that simple.
Letters.
We have to go to a break. But let me, before we do, go into a break reading Cheryl's letter, who says, all of you are wasting your time talking and talking. and talking and talking. It is time to stand. Stand for the truth, stand for the Constitution, and stand for our country. I'm sure you all recognize the following. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. What is occurring in our country right now is what will speak for us in the history, herstory of our country. We must stand. That's from Cheryl. We'll hear from you.
I thought it was Abe Lincoln.
Right after.
Yeah, me too. But that's okay.
Thank you for your letter.
We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. Let me just reestablish and let you know who's on the panel this morning. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is here. Former New York 19th Congressman John Faso, political consultant Libby Post, and investment banker on Wall Street Mark Whitman are all here. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We have a lot of letters on Russia. I will get to more of those toward the end of our time together. I do want to get a couple issues in. John has to leave at 10:30, so I want to make sure that we hit a couple of other things before he has to actually go work. So, Trump issues order to expand his power over agencies that Congress made independent. The president has already challenged statutory protections against summarily firing officials overseeing such agencies without cause. What are we talking about here? Well, we are talking about the executive order that seeks greater authority over regulatory agencies that Congress established as independent. The order requires independent agencies to submit their proposed regulations to the White House for review, asserts a power to block such agencies from spending funds on projects or efforts that conflict with presidential priorities, and declares that they must accept the president's and Justice Department's interpretation of the law as binding. The order follows Mr. Trump's summary firings of leaders of independent agencies in defiance of statutes that bar their removal without cause before their terms are up. Collectively, the moves constitute a major front in the president's assault on the shape of the American government and his effort to seize some of the Congress's constitutional power over it. The agencies include the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, and the National Labor Relations Board. Still, the order applies only partly to one particularly powerful agency, the Federal Reserve, covering issues related to its supervision and regulation of Wall Street, but exempting its decisions related to monetary policy like raising and lowering interest rates. Who would like to begin? Mark, John, go ahead.
Well, this gets into the classic case that everyone knows who follows the Supreme Court, the case of Humphrey's executor. Humphrey's executor was decided in 1935 because what Donald Trump is attempting to do is exactly what Franklin Delano Roosevelt did, which spurred the case of Humphrey's executor. Humphrey was a member of the Federal Trade Commission, as I recall, and he was not supportive of many of the New Deal policies. FDR was not happy, and so he fired Mr. Humphrey. And the case is called Humphrey's Executor because Humphrey died during the pendency of the case. And what was Humphrey's executor seeking? He was seeking the back pay for Humphrey to be paid to his estate. So what Donald Trump is actually doing here is very consistent with what FDR did in 1933 or 4 when the case was decided in 1935. And the issue is, it's an issue that's they are doing this to get this issue in front of the Supreme Court. Many people on the conservative side who believe in the so-called unitary executive theory of governance believe that these agencies which Congress has established, which have both executive and legislative powers, that they fundamentally conflict with the Constitution, which invests all executive power in the presidency. I think it's a very interesting case from a federal powers, separation of powers point of view, because the Congress has created these agencies to be technically independent of the executive, but they give them significant executive and legislative duties. So it's going to wind up in the Supreme Court. I think that when it comes to issues that may touch upon the president's foreign policy powers, for instance, USAID, I think there's a stronger case to be made for presidential authority. But when it comes to these other issues like the Federal Trade Commission and the SEC, submitting their regulatory actions to the OMB, I don't think is particularly controversial. But the issue of whether or not the president can unilaterally fire appointees who have designated terms, I think that's going to be a real tough question for the Supreme Court. I would tend to think that the president is likely to lose in that argument in the Supreme Court as it relates to these purely domestic agencies. I don't think, though, I think his position will be stronger as it relates to his foreign policy powers under the Constitution. So the Humphreys executor case, does it survive? It's an open question.
Okay, but the Humphreys executor case was about one guy. It was a political difference between FDR and Humphrey. This is an entire department. This is an entire agency. That's different. I mean, a number of agencies. I mean, it's not just like I want you to do what I say and I don't like what you're doing, so I'm going to fire you. This is I want to have complete power and control over your agency. I mean, that is fundamentally
over
different.
your independent agency.
It really isn't fundamentally different, Joe, because if the president has the power to fire the appointees to those independent agency commissions, if he does have that power, as FDR asserted and as Donald Trump is asserting, then he's going to have more power over the actions of the agency. But
now, the cool thing is that Humphrey just kept coming to work. He never left.
But the Supreme Court
never left. Like, he just kept going in and doing his job.
He kept getting paid even after.
Oh, yeah. I hear he's still getting Social Security.
Yeah, probably.
Yes, that's true. But the thing is that the Supreme Court ruled in favor.
Can we take a half step back? Yeah. I think this is a
this,
no.
Seriously,
no offense.
Seriously.
John, I respect you a lot, but I think this argument about the unitary executive when it comes to mega world is like states' rights to the racists in the 60s.
Yeah.
It's a smokescreen to get what they want done. There's a great article in opinion piece in the Financial Times by Martin Wolf, which to me, I think provides a great explanation of what we see going on. And frankly, I've had headaches over trying to figure it out. But institutions in this country, particularly a well-run state, provide predictability and security to our nation. And the U.S. professionalized the civil service with the Pendleton Act back in 1883, John, just to go back into history with you. Trump and his acolytes attack this so-called deep state, saying that it threatens democracy. Why? Because they want to shift government from competent, loyal public service to personal loyalists and those who help the wealthy. And if you look historically at countries, those who have done a better job of professionalizing and if you will, neutralizing the operation of the state are the societies that have been far more successful. But Trump and his acolytes want to dismantle that system. They want to replace experienced civil service with loyalists. How do we know that? Because you literally have to answer the question, what is 2 + 2 equal? It equals 5. Because Trump won the 2020 election, or you don't even get hired by this new administration. Vance, Kash Patel, they've all been hung out, sort of trying to repeat extreme versions of this nonsense that Trump has said about the states. So the claims of improving efficiency are entirely...
Are you reading that?
Yes, partially. I got notes on this.
Yeah, okay.
The claims of efficiency are entirely ridiculous. If you look, John, you and I will both admit, if you look at how this nation spends money, what Musk and Trump have done so far isn't a drop in the bucket. So why are they doing all the work? Why all the fireworks? It's because they literally want to manipulate the state so that they can manipulate information and weaken the institutional checks. Once they've done that, they're going to replace everybody with loyalists. And basically what they do is not only deprofessionalize the United States government, but they also make it much more subject to state capture.
Well, my point was just simply trying to explain the legal question before us, which is, does the president have this power? And it's going to come to the Supreme Court as to whether Humphrey's executor will stand. I frankly don't think that this attack on the independent agencies is really worthwhile, because ultimately the president is going to have sufficient appointees to basically have his political imprint on the agency. But they're attempting to do it in one fell swoop. And I think that's going to be a problem. I don't believe the Supreme Court is going to uphold it.
But, John, you minimized or sanitized this issue of information having to go to the OMB director to vote, to Russ vote from the FCC. So you're saying that it's just not a big deal, this shift, to saying that their decisions have to be approved by the director of OMB, that their budgets and how they spend their money, this independent agency.
They're regulatory.
This is the Federal Communications Commission.
Yeah.
They want to control communications. This is the SEC. Mark, you can speak better to this than I can. But financing and the direction that goes, because they can't directly control the Fed. It's the Federal Trade Commission. They're dismantling these entities that support consumers, just like dismantling the Consumer Finance Protection Board, right? This is not just anything. This is trying to gain control of communications.
I'm not discounting
that power to OMB when Congress has designated these as independent,
right.
And he has kept. I mean, my first job in Washington was actually doing an oversight, but a review of the FCC and interviewing every commissioner and profiling them, and they are design so the appointments are scattered over time so that one president or administration cannot dominate them. Now, sometimes it happens, but they are designed to be independent, and this would dramatically shift that, and in ways that people won't really understand because it's complex, change our grip on the communications.
What's your John's response?
All I'm saying, Teresa, is that I personally doubt whether the Supreme Court will accept this analysis. I think they will uphold the independence of these agencies. But I do think that this is a question which the Trump administration is trying to bring to the fore, because they're trying to overturn Humphrey's executor to give the president more authority. And in doing so, they're doing what FDR tried to do in 1935.
They're trying to shift they're trying to shift the Constitution.
They're trying to
fundamentally change our balance of power.
Right.
And again, where are the Republicans in the House and the Senate?
These agencies
because
aren't
they
in the
are
Constitution,
losing
Teresa.
Their control.
They were constructs.
The balance of what is in the Constitution is the balance of power.
Correct.
Right? That's what's in the Constitution. And the Republicans in the House and the Senate are ceding their power. Right. Why? Why are they doing that?
But John, I get that there are a lot of parallels between this and FDR. But you got to remember, before World War II, most Americans' only interface with the government was the Postal Service, right? So to say that what Trump did... No, but it's true.
But just watching the popcorn.
In many cases, that's still the case.
So my point is that the state capture that the Republicans are trying to affect here is on a totally grand scale. It's non-comparable, although I get it. Some of the nuanced legal arguments are the same. Look, the big issue here is the president is, if planes keep falling from the sky for the next 4 years, we're going to look to the FAA and to the president and then say, what the heck is going on? The administration needs to do something about this.
Well, he's just going to blame DEI.
Let me just frame this argument. But yeah, probably.
But
the president's only there for 4 years. And you don't want the president making decisions about whether or not the wing should fall away when your Embraer slides down the runway. You need a professional, well-informed, balanced civil service. So the tension here is, how much power should the president have? And we haven't seen a power grab like this attempted in a government since the Chinese Cultural Revolution,
and
frankly.
And a side note on that airplane that flipped over, they want to deregulate everything. And they know regulations, deregulate everything. What kept those people alive? Regulations that required airplanes to have the seats embedded into the floor so they wouldn't fall if something like this happened. Regulations that required seat belts. Regulations that changed the design. And the reason those people lived is because when the plane flipped over, the seats didn't fall off and they didn't fall out of their seats. That's what kept those people alive. You want to deregulate everything, you're going to kill people.
And
that's exactly my point.
Why the chaos at the FAA?
Why?
Because top guy went after Musk.
Go ahead. Well, I just have to say, we're just a little levity here, but one of my favorite interviews this week, when the plane went over and after it happened, and on CNN, one of the anchors asked a former member of the FAA, well, why didn't the slides work? And
the plane was upside down.
And the person said, just blank face said, well, they would have been upside down.
Right. Okay. And you would have had to like sort of hold on to them and slide down.
It was my favorite journalistic moment of the week.
Right. Look, we have an administration of people who do not care about their fellow men and women. They do not. So if people die, it's okay. You've got women dying all over this country because of Dobbs, because they're being forced to carry dead fetuses to term, and it's toxic, and women are dying because of that. Women are bleeding out in parking lots because they can't get the medical care that they need. RFK Jr. is going to redo the childhood vaccine schedule. We all know how important those vaccines are. You, all of us in this room, are relatively healthy, except for all of my joint replacements, because we were vaccinated as children.
Well,
okay,
at your age, we have to expect.
Yes,
these
well,
things.
This is true.
Yes,
but we were vaccinated as children, so we're relatively healthy. We're not dealing with polio. What's going on in Texas? They've got a measles outbreak. Oh, because vaccines really don't work. Well, some of those kids are going to die.
I was trying to explain Humphrey's executive.
Yeah, no, I get it.
I wasn't getting into all these issues.
But the thing is that it's about the neglect.
But
the,
you're making
the
it
neglect.
Sound like it's nothing, John.
Right.
Going
the,
after
it's
the
neglect.
The FCC.
Hold on, one at a time.
It's about the neglect of humanity that characterizes this administration. They don't care about the people. They care about money and expanding corporate interests, and that's about it. And so, you know, Humphrey's executor, maybe the Supreme Court will uphold it. Maybe they won't, because this is his court. So we'll see. I don't think John Roberts wants to be known as the Supreme Court Chief Justice who let democracy die on his watch. But that's what we're looking at.
By the way, on vaccines, this is the anniversary, 1905, U.S. Supreme Court in Jacobson versus Massachusetts upheld 7-2 compulsory vaccination laws intended to protect public health.
Yeah, right. What's wrong?
I do think that it's an interesting backdrop in terms of the legal issues that you raise. And there's a separate one on the Kennedy Center that I learned last night about Sean Spicer that I thought was fascinating. But what worries me is that what is the context in which this is happening right now, and the slippery slope to losing control, public control of communications, and this unitarian, tell me the rule.
Unitary theory
unitary,
of the executive.
Right, which is Russ Vote, Project 2025, America's First. That is what they've been working on for a long, long time.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I'm trying to do is explain that the issue of the appointees to these so-called independent agencies is going to get challenged in the United States Supreme Court. Does the president have the authority, as FDR asserted, to remove the appointees of these independent agencies? And like I said, I'm doubtful that the president's argument will prevail in the Supreme Court, but we will see.
Okay, just to make my point, the New York Times headline just came out. Trump team plans deep cuts at office that funds recovery from big disasters.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And he's laying off 9,000 IRS right. workers.
You know, he'll be just throwing paper towels at people.
But then this will all go to the courts. The question is, and there it's not that you can't find inefficiencies or whatever. Clinton Gore showed that in the reinventing government. And now the Republicans are pointing to that as, see, they did it too. They did it completely differently. And right. you know that, John. They did it in a completely different way that involved the workforce, that they did the research, found the problems, and then made the changes. This is in reverse. They're firing people almost. I mean, it seems like there's three different things going on. There's the Russ Vote folks and J.D. Vance and Peter Thiel, and that's the Project 2025 and the America First Foundation. They've been at this for a while. They really want to see a shift in power. Trump seems to be just on a vengeance campaign, you know, get mm-hmm. everybody out who affronted him. And more globally, the Republicans want the tax cut. And what we're not talking about is the legal process that is happening going through the House and the Senate, these budget bills. And setting, you know, what they want to find $4 trillion. They want $2 trillion to pay for their tax cuts, or $4 trillion, $2 trillion raise a deficit, $2 trillion they've got to cut from the federal budget so that their tax cuts are paid for. That's what's really underneath a lot of this. How do you get to those numbers? You don't get to those numbers. Trump's as yesterday, oh, we're not going to cut Medicare or Social Security or Medicaid. You don't get to that without cutting Medicaid. And their plans on paper that the House is about to vote for has what, $830 billion in Medicaid cuts? Is that right, John?
Yeah, that's about right. And you're correct.
We have about 90 seconds before John has to leave, so we'll give John the floor.
Well, the whole reconciliation issue is something that we don't have enough time to talk about here today, but that's going to be a key issue, whether they can cobble together enough support in the House among Republicans mm-hmm. to pass these reconciliation bills. The other issue is going to be the funding of the government, which expires on March 14th because the Congress was unable to pass full-year appropriation bills. I was one of those that argued they should have passed a full year extension in this fiscal year, fiscal 25, last December, so they didn't have to wind up in this situation in March. But that's where we are. And that has to be done on a bipartisan basis because they can't pass anything in the Senate without having 60 votes. So you need Democratic votes to pass the government funding.
And they're not negotiating with the Democrats.
Oh, they are. They're negotiating with the Democrats on the appropriations measure because they
have to. The House?
Yes, the House and Senate are definitely negotiating. Susan Collins is the chairman, and Patty Murray from Washington State is the ranking Democratic member on the Senate Finance Committee, and so they are Appropriations Committee, and they are attempting to come up with top lines. Similarly, in the House, Rosa DeLauro and Tom Cole are in that negotiation. Where they go, I mean, I think this is going to be a real issue coming forward.
John, we appreciate you being here as always. Thank you very much.
Great to be here. And I love talking about Humphrey's executive.
I know. It's a very cool story. It's worth looking at.
But, and I love the fact that FDR had the same position as Donald Trump.
Oh, come on.
Let's not go too far,
and
John.
With that bomb drop,
right.
We'll be back
that's
right
a bit
after
much.
This. Thank you.
Necesitaba tus besos, tus caricias y tu amor.
Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Left in our steel cage match, we have Teresa Bourgeois, Levy Post, and Mark Whitman. Although with John gone, I guess it's really not a steel cage match anymore, is it?
It's great to have him on. He's
oh,
fantastic.
My God. We love
He's
him.
Fantastic.
He's the best. And thanks, everybody. We'll get to some more letters. I want to get to one or two more issues before our time elapses this morning. Let me go to the story on congestion pricing. This is there's a lot that went on with this. Of course, this is, Teresa was saying before about how many things, you know, many stories come out of one story. And this is an example of that. So Mayor Adams is involved in this in some way. There's the congestion pricing. There is the Kathy Hochul decision as to that this being a bargaining chip. And then Trump just moving to end New York's congestion pricing, and finally, last but certainly not least, giving him the opportunity to post that he was long live the king, mm-hmm. and to in a Time magazine like parody of him with a crown on, in a painting overlooking the skyline of Manhattan. Then he posted on Truth Social yesterday. President Trump intends to revoke federal approval of New York City's congestion pricing program, fulfilling a campaign promise to reverse the policy that tolls drivers who enter Manhattan's busiest streets to help finance repairs to mass transit. This from the New York Times. In a letter to Governor Kathy Hochul on Wednesday, the president's transportation secretary outlined Mr. Trump's objections to the program, the first of its kind in the nation, and said that federal officials would contact the state to, quote, discuss the orderly cessation of toll operations. The letter from Sean Duffy, the transportation secretary, cited the cost to working class motorists, the use of revenue from the tolls for transit upgrades rather than roads, and the reach of the program compared with the plan approved by federal legislation as reasons for the decision. Mr. Duffy did not indicate a specific date by which the federal government intended to end the program. By the way, let's not forget that this program has been ping-ponging back mm-hmm. and forth in the state for well over a year.
Right.
Oh, Mike, just let's go back to the history. Mike Bloomberg, remember him?
Yes.
Proposed this, I believe, in 2006.
No, I mean as far as, yes, you're absolutely
right. Oh, and then there's the issue of the Kathy Hochul, who was for it and then shut it down during an election period, and then turned it back on at 2/3 the charge that it was going to be at initially.
That's what I'm talking about the last year. Congestion pricing is dead. Manhattan and all of New York is saved, shouty caps, Trump wrote. Long live the king.
Well,
Ms. Hochul defended the congestion pricing program on Wednesday and vowed to fight the president's move. We are a nation of laws, not ruled by a king, she said in a written statement. We will see you in court. Libby Post.
So I was in New York Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And I know Monday was President's Day, but I left New York on Tuesday. And I have to say, I have never gotten out of New York City quicker than I did that day. And I left midday, right, where you can, when you think that there'd be a lot of traffic. And so there wasn't. I was able to get down.
You drive?
In New York?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I love driving in New York.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I mean,
okay.
I grew up down there. Right?
No,
you know,
I know.
It's not that big of a deal.
But
I got through 47th that brought me back to the West Side Highway, like in 5 minutes from Midtown. I was at the Marriott Marquis.
Yeah.
Right?
Right,
you know,
in Times Square.
Right in Times Square. And so it is working. It is easing traffic. The political machinations around all of this, I get why people got upset, you know, oh, it was just a political move to suspend it when she did, but it was also about taking back houses, seats in the House, which honestly was a little more important given what we're facing now in Washington, D.C. But this is overreach as far as I'm concerned. Now, I know that Phil Murphy from New Jersey isn't happy about it and blah, blah, blah. But the fact of the matter is that the MTA needs funding, and if this is a way of being able to generate funds to do the upgrades that the MTA needs so that people can safely travel on the buses and in the subway, I'm okay with it. I would have been fine if I had gotten charged on Sunday, because they don't charge you on Sundays. I would have been fine being charged the $9. It's $20-something to go over the George Washington Bridge. You know, no matter where you go, if you're on a toll road, it's going to cost you money. It's just part of the deal. And, you know, I remember it being said that the tolls that they had put on the New York State Thruway were not going to last forever because it was only there to pay for the thruway. Well, we're still paying those tolls, and we're going to continue to pay those tolls because they have to keep upgrading the thruway. And the same thing with this.
But the details of the issue, I think, are really interesting, Libby. But don't you think this is not really about the substance of the issue? This is about Trump going after the power centers right now. I mean, think about the ranking minority in the Senate from New York, the ranking in the House from New York, right? And this is Trump trying to assert control. In the context of Trump saying, oh, let's give everything back to the states. Let's give education, move it back to the states.
Except
FEMA, let's move
like.
It back to the states. Let's move everything back to the states, except for decisions like this, because he can create tension within the New York State among the suburban groups and the city groups, or vaccinations. Look, it's everything back to the states, but he signs the executive order saying schools won't get funding unless they agree that you aren't required to have a COVID vaccination. This is just him playing politics, trying to put pressure on key leaders.
I think this also has to do with immigration. I think he was trying to get Hochul to capitulate on ICE and being able to go into schools and go into churches and do whatever. She said no.
Again, a distraction, because how are they doing on their pledge on immigration?
Yeah, not so very well. But the thing is that this was a negotiation, I think, from Trump. He didn't have to do this. If the governor had capitulated on the immigration issues, this probably wouldn't have happened.
I think it's just a bully distraction. I don't think it's great.
I think
strategy.
It's all bullying distractions. It's all bullying distractions. Everything he does is that. But I think that this was part of all of this, is that he wanted New York to capitulate on immigration. That's far more important to him than congestion pricing.
Mark Whitman, is it a bullying distraction?
In large part. It's also he's trying to bolster Republican politicians in the area. And I would challenge Nicole Meliotakis and Mike Lawler to just kind of come up with the funding, the billions of dollars that the MTA might not get if this ever does go through. By the way, I just a point of clarification, Libby, as to the electric sewer. The money that's being spent primarily is about the reliability and usability of the system, not about safety. It's an incredibly, despite the headlines around safety issues, it is much safer to be in the electric sewer than above ground if you're traveling in and out of New York City.
Are you calling the subways an electric sewer?
Yes, I am. And during my career when I lived down there, I used it assiduously. I, for better or worse, when I lived in Brooklyn Heights and worked in Manhattan, if it was faster than going across the Brooklyn Bridge, so I had to take the electric sewer. I think it's the right move to have congestion pricing in place. I was disappointed that Hochul decreased the amount of the toll, and I do think it's true that Trump is using this for his political purposes. And I underscore Teresa's comment about, as I said before, states' rights is like the unitary executive theory. It's something people hide behind depending on how they're feeling about a particular
issue. They were starting to get bad press around the immigration stuff because they were misstating claims about who they were gathering up, and the numbers are lower. And I think they're looking for distractions, and they found this to be a useful one.
Oh, that's true. And I wanted to highlight one thing. There was one where the new Secretary of Homeland Defense, what's her name, please? Kristi Noem?
Yeah. Yes.
Put on that vest and was part of a raid. Do you know how many people who are subject potentially to deportation they actually found in that raid?
One.
So the Secretary of Homeland Defense came from Washington, left from Washington to Newark or New Jersey, whichever it was. They put on this whole big raid and they pick up one person. Imagine how many times you have to do that to get to 11 million.
They had media
million.
Come on the raids. It wasn't working. They sent a plane, their $800,000 planes with 10 people on it. They gathered up a group of Venezuelans. More than half of them had no criminal background whatsoever, violent criminal background, which they said that they did. And on and on and on. They had apologized to India for putting those folks in shackles. I mean, it's just... anyway, are we going to get to NIH?
No, we're...
Right. There's one other thing about congestion pricing. My good friend Deborah Glick just texted me, and this is about the governor's race and helping Michael Lawler. And that is absolutely correct.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because
I knew it was a suburban thing.
Yeah, if the Democrats are smart, they will put him and Maliotakis on the hook for the billions. Mm. They'll ask every day, what have you got for us, since you don't want congestion pricing to save the subway?
If you remember, before we went to our last break, I promised that we would get to the scores of letters that we had regarding regarding Rush. And I want to include letters. We asked for letters from our listeners. We got a ton of them, so I'm just going to read through them in our last 4 minutes of the program. Here we go. Susan says, when Russia invaded Ukraine 3 years ago, there were many who were blaming Ukraine for provoking Russia by talking about Ukrainians joining NATO. Not me, for sure, but MAGA people, yes. After the takeover of Crimea in 2014, who could blame them for wanting to join NATO? And thank you, John Faso, for speaking up clearly. All the rest of you, too. Then we go to Anonymous. Sure, the price of oil factors into the peace negotiations in Saudi, but President Real Estate wants the Saudis to come into the picture when developing Gaza. Peace is only a shroud for Trump. All he cares about is himself and more money. Then Linda, didn't Obama's failure to stop the stealing of Crimea start all of this? Please address this. You never read these kinds of letters. That's not true. Don't be afraid to bring this up. Just give us an answer, please.
The answer is yes. And the Democrats, by the way, failed miserably during the presidential election when they never hold Trump to account for the fact that the invasion that he said would never happen continued on his watch during his first presidency.
Let's go to Stuart. Donald Trump is mentally unbalanced. Everything he does, all the positions he takes, are in service of his malignant narcissism. A panel of psychiatrists would be more valuable than policy analysis. Then we go to Denise. Trump being called a transactional president is the, quote, nice way of saying that Trump is the quid pro quo president.
He's a grifter.
Then we go to Jerome. Panel, during the recess, how do the congressional representatives square Trump's pro-Russia policy with the 81% pro-Ukraine of our population? That'll be an interesting point and question to be answered. Then we go to Mark, the turnabout, not our Mark, a different Mark. To the turnout on Ukraine may well unite Europe, but it will be a Europe united in suspicion about the U.S. and whether we continue to share values. The damage to the Atlantic Alliance is incalculable. Real quick, a couple more. We go to Mark. John. I don't know what you all expect him or anyone to do. The Russians are winning the war. They overwhelmingly have more troops, and the Ukrainians are limited. There's nothing the West can do. All the arms in the world won't make up for the size of the forces in the field, notwithstanding the fact that we don't have the arms to give them. The war is lost. Accept it. What's the alternative? What negotiating leverage do the Ukrainians have? Or NATO. So we'll end there with that letter from John. Many more that we didn't get to, but my thanks to all of you for taking the time out to write. My thanks even more to Teresa Bourgeois, Mark Whitman, and the yesterday birthday girl, Libby Post. Thank you all very much. We'll be back with more program right after this.